Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome back to the official Project Blue Book podcast. I'm your host, Tara Bennett, a senior producer for Sci-Fi Wire. This week's episode features a seminal UFO sighting event, the Lubbock Lights. We are officially on episode 1.3, and so taking us through all of it is showrunner and executive producer Sean Jablonski. Hello.
Hello. Nice to be back.
And this week we are thrilled to have with us some cast members. We've got in the studio Michael Harney, who plays General Valentine. Hello, sir.
Hello, ma'am. How are you?
Great. And on the phone, the frick to General Valentine's frack is General Harding. We have Neil McDonough. Hello.
Hey, guys. How are you?
So great to have you. This is such a great episode in terms of drawing together what was going on culturally at the time. We've got all of the Russian Cold War, nuclear war, fear. We've got what's going on with just the general populace freaking out. And then Lubbock has something very specific in the sky making everyone freaking out. So we'll go to Sean. What inspires a good case so that you can tell some good stories?
This one was kind of easy, and I know we spoke before about how we wanted to kind of have this trajectory with respect to the cases where we start out with, first, it's like a single person in the sky, then you have a family on the ground that's maybe not as credible. This was moved into the idea of multiple witnesses. There's that great moment in the classroom. How many people have seen those lights in the sky? And there's like 30 hands that go up. The notion of Hynek and Quinn coming in and having to deal with so many different versions of a story and versions of what could possibly be the cause of it, as well as a photograph that was taken, which is a very famous photograph. I'd encourage anybody who's curious about the case, you can go online and see it. And of course, we have a very real-world explanation, which our generals give, which was it is the V-wing fighter, right? That aspect of it also really deepens the sort of government conspiracy angle, and we see just how deep the generals are involved in it as well. It just felt like it was also, you know, if you look at 10 episodes as almost like a three-act play, your first three are sort of your act one, right? And you have your middle four, your act two, and your final three. This felt like a good end of act one, sort of like, oh, wow, we're really in deep here. So this is how we came
and
to
it's
that
expanding,
episode.
Yeah. Got a room and a city that's freaking out over this whole situation. When you're looking at the government aspect of the generals, we've got, you know, General Valentine, General Harding. So when you're looking for these two kind of authoritarian figures that are really dictating everything that Quinn and Hynek are doing, what were you looking for and how did you come upon Michael and Neil?
First and foremost, it's being able to walk the walk and have that air of authenticity and authority. And I've said this before, and it's true.
Go for it. Blow my ego a little bit here.
No. I mean, it's true. I mean, the truth is like, you know, we really, really tried to get Anthony Hopkins. He wasn't available. And so somebody said, what about Neil McDonough? And I said, who?
Exactly. I said the same thing. I don't even know who he is.
Truthfully, you guys were at the top of our list. It's a very small list when you start looking, I have to be honest. There are plenty of people you could get who could probably do an okay job, but when you want to do your wish list, you start looking. And both Michael and Neil were at the top of our list. And
thank you.
God bless our producing partners as well as the studio. David and I are especially dogs with a bone with that. We're like, this has to happen. Mm-hmm. I'll say little inside baseball, but Neil happened to be at the time also working on another show up in Vancouver, which was serendipitous to some degree, except for the fact that he wasn't always available. But the fact that he was able to work with us and I happened to know the showrunner up there as well and I could call him and I wound up sending him a case of wine.
Whatever works, man.
To
That's
say
good.
Thank you very much for helping us out. And we were very fortunate. So
it must have been a nice case of wine.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't easy, I know.
Yeah. It had to be top show.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask both of you, and we'll start with Michael. when you get a script like this coming across, what was most interesting to you? Was it just that it was Project Blue Book, or was there something about a military character that you get some insight into how they played their part in this for a very long time secret organization?
I was aware of Professor Hynek when I was in college, and I had read about him and actually spoke with several of my professors his work. So it was very odd for me to have a full circle type of experience. And in terms of playing the character, for me, it had a lot to do with finding what was going to motivate me in regards to suppressing information.
Yeah.
I could really feel on an organic level what could happen in terms of public hysteria, especially at that time. You mentioned the Cold War. Yeah. There was a lot on the table. So I think that for me, really having a reason to to do whatever we have to do to keep information from being seen in the light of day was important. And then just the aspect of carrying a lot of information that the general population is not privy to or will ever be privy to, that became very interesting to embody. And then working off this guy, Neil, I mean, you know, he's a top-shelf guy, you know. He gets people send top-shelf cases of wine.
You're in demand, Neil. Like that, you know.
And for me, to be honest, hearing that Robert Zemeckis was involved, I knew that the catering and the craft service would be really top-notch.
You are
and
a man
that knows.
That's
kind of why I jumped on. You know, you got to know these things in Hollywood. You have to. In all seriousness, when it first came, when I heard about it, and that it was Robert Zemeckis, obviously, you knew it was going to have a stamp of approval, and you knew that it would be so entertaining to watch. There's tons of eye candy, and he would get to the specifics of what happened at that time and do it with bravery, and that's what these guys did. It was really a pleasure to be part of that history, which is fantastic, to say, wow, this is what happened here, to play a historical character like myself, to see what he did and where he'd been, the things that they had done. That's fantastic in itself, but also to work opposite Michael and Aiden and the other Michael. And, you know, it was tons of fun. We really enjoyed the moments, especially when Sean was there directing us. There's this great feeling of we're doing something really pretty cool here, and I really enjoyed that immensely. And, you know, again, it's just a really cool topic to be part of and to play a historical figure that was in the Air Force, and my father being in the Air Force back in the late 40s and 50s. I really enjoyed jumping into his boots, that's for sure.
As we know, the series is based on real people that existed. What was your note from Sean or the writers about where you guys should be digging into at least amalgamations of characters that may have inspired yours? Or did you go on your own research and find characters in history that you said, you know what, yeah, I think I'm going to lean into this?
I think when you play a historical character, you can't sway too far from what the truth is, obviously. Mm-hmm. Or else you're not going to do a service to it's a real-life guy and he has a family and everything else. So I think the key to playing for me and when talking with Sean earlier and David was it's embracing the gray area of things. There's a black and white job that the generals have in this, and that's to keep truth from the public or else it will be mass hysteria, as Michael was saying. It was really playing the grayness. And, you know, I don't know anyone in life who's really evil or anyone who's really, really good. That doesn't really exist. Everyone has their flaws and mistakes. And to embrace that as an actor, that's what you're really hoping for. And then you can really dig into the character. And then you get those great words to boot, and it was a home run for us.
I used a couple of guys that I worked off of, guys that were going back and forth from Washington mm-hmm. back to specific duties in the military and having to do with making major decisions or being part of major decisions in Washington. And then working with a group of men that were making secret decisions, mm-hmm. which were major influencing moves in government and world politics and the way things are done and carried out. All that became very, very interesting in terms of embodying someone that's involved in that type of work because it caused me to, I was more somber during the shooting. You just get into a place, it's a zone, I guess. And I know some guys, friends who have worked in high-level security positions and intelligence in our country, and they just carry a lot. Very, very difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
You'd never know it talking to them on a regular day-to-day, but if you know them personally, you can tell it's very difficult at times.
Sean, tell me a little bit about when you guys are building out a season, you're thinking of and how much you want to allow us to see their stories expand. Without giving away spoilers, but in terms of crafting characters.
We were inspired, obviously, by some of the real-life generals that were part of Project Blue Book and MJ-12. So looking at part of their history was a good sort of jumping-off point. But for us, in terms of how we wanted to have them interact with our Hynek and Quinn, yeah. They are the balance there, right? They're the sort of, I mean, they're the military line, but you also, as Neil pointed out too, you don't want to make them a caricature.
Right.
They're not bad. We never wanted to judge. That was the other thing. I kept saying that in the room. We're not judging anybody here. We're not trying to make anybody bad, per se. We're mm-hmm. not trying to say they're covering up something out of any sort of malice. It's a tremendous responsibility for anybody in that position to hold on to that information, to keep it from the public. You're doing your job. You're trying to keep people safe. And sometimes that means you have to sort of hold it in. And then trying to make sure that they felt authentic in their roles, mm-hmm. and then to create the relationship with each other. It's a multi sort of pronged process, yeah. you know? And also once, I'm sure somebody in this room can correct me, but I think it was John Ford who says, you don't direct, you cast.
Yeah.
And so once you cast these guys, you go, okay, well, knowing what they're capable of doing and what you can write to and whatnot, and then to play with that as well.
Yeah.
Go, let's see if we push this a little here, how that would work.
So. Well, speaking of playing, because I got to ask about a specific scene that Harding has with, if you're a nerd in the world of X-Files, Stephen Williams appears playing chess against General Harding. He's known as X in the X-Files. So you see that and you go, ooh, that's an interesting casting call. And certainly it allows us to see General Harding in a different way, in that he is kind of in his civvies playing a game of strategy against somebody.
Conscious,
so let's talk a little about why that exists in this episode.
Neil, I'll just say, like, in terms of where that even came from, it was, again, a very conscious effort to go, look, these are real people. You know, they're not just the uniform. They're not just the military. And what does he do when he's not there?
Mm-hmm.
How does this guy operate in the real world around real people? And so we married a little bit of plot with a very personal story mm-hmm. in that moment. And that's where that scene came out of.
I have a feeling that maybe we'll see more out of that somewhere down the line. That's specific casting.
That was one fun scene to shoot. It was like two prize fighters kind of going at it, constricted to being able to just sit in a chair and not being able to do much, and everything had to be with our faces, and we would listen to each other. It was one of those just really fun acting scenes where you get to kind of stretch it out with someone that you really admire working with. Again, that's a great thing that they've devised in the show, that you might think that the generals are the bad guys. Well, you see this, okay, they're normal guys. They have a job to do. Their job is very different than my job, but it's their job to do. So to see the real human, regular side of Harding was really a fantastic thing for my character and the audience. I think they're going to really, really dig that too.
Harley Payton is the writer of this episode, and he has been on Channel Zero. He also got an Emmy nomination for the original Twin Peaks.
That's right.
So wheelhouse is exactly what you're looking for with this show. And then Pete Travis was the director for two episodes, and if you know Dredd, he directed that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a beautiful-looking episode, and when you have to recreate the Lubbock lights, you get all this really great nighttime stuff, mysterious setups for how it all plays out in the episode. Tell me a little bit about what Harley wanted to bring to it just in terms of the spin, because it's not a typical depiction in terms of it's not just about the lights. And then what Pete wanted to bring to the table just in terms of how he wanted it to look and how you guys all wanted that seminal moment to come to life in your series.
So I'll jump in and give the brief thing about Harley, and then I'd love to hear what Michael and Neil think of Pete. I will say I thought he did a tremendous, tremendous job. I really loved him. I love his work. I thought he elevated episodes 3 and 4. He's really one of my favorites of the series. So love Pete. Worked very closely with him during the process as well, which was great. I always love working closely with directors. And in terms of the story, you know, look, Harley, he's been doing this forever.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? I love him. He's such a tremendous, tremendous writer. Part of this, too, was also it got diluted to some degree in service of other ideas. But part of also what motivated the story, too, was the notion that Quinn was in the military, as he said, escorting bombers over Berlin when he was this age. And so to put him in an environment that he missed was a chance to sort of see a character moment. And then to lose his moment with the grad student, and then to have a kind of almost romantic moment with Hynek out in the field.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It was a way to sort of service that you're telling a story about their relationship, about his past, and you're in an investigation. That's where I think the show works the best.
Yeah.
So now I'm curious how you guys felt about Pete.
I love Pete.
Yeah.
He's real laid back. And I just love guys that just let me do my thing.
That's
you know?
Nice. Yes.
And, you know, with Neil, it's easy. So,
Thanks, buddy.
We just kind of go on the ride.
Yeah.
You know?
He created such a chilled environment that for actors, it makes it so organic and fun just to have a director like that. And again, to work with Michael, we spent so much time together between scenes and talking to each other and getting to know each other. And it was such a warm time for me as an actor to hang out with these guys and to work with Michael, who's just ridiculously talented. My coach in college used to say, when you play with not so talented people, your game goes down. But when you play against talented teams, your game goes way up. And working with Michael, my game and everyone else's game went way up because he's so dialed in and ready to go. And I love that.
I feel the same, brother.
Thanks, Pally. Thank you.
So I want to ask also about when Alan and Quinn are out in the field to see Tom, the victim that we see initially at the beginning. We had to see his car. And I loved seeing something that was such a different way of showing an after effect. The rippling in that car was so cool. So tell me a little bit about how that came to be.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out. That actually took a lot of work to get
that.
And a lot of models, a lot of conversations. I will say, I did remember very early on saying, we want it to look like nothing we've seen before.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And there's a lot of instances where you have burn marks or things that have encountered with cars or other physical human elements that have left a mark of some kind. I wanted something to feel like as soon as you saw it, hit you immediately, that mm-hmm. there was no investigation needed. As soon as you saw it, you would go, that doesn't look right at all. Whatever did that is not of this earth mm-hmm. sort of thing. And yet there is what he says, the idea of certain electrical impulses can affect tensile strength. That part is true. So again, we're always trying to find like a logical, reasonable explanation for something. But you know, it's funny, you shoot that when you see the dailies, they walk up on a regular truck and you're looking at a regular truck for months while you're waiting for these shots to come in.
Yeah.
So you keep going. I think there's like the 30th version of it because it's like, no, crack the headlight,
yeah.
you know, do the thing.
Yeah.
It takes a while, but they nailed it. Our special effects guys are great. They nailed it.
They look so
for sure.
cool. I wanted to go back to something, Michael, that you had said because you had an early interest in Hynek and then you got to play a scene at the end of this episode and the one previously where, you know, you're kind of telling Alan, just take the paycheck and go do what we tell you to do. But getting to play against somebody that is inhabiting somebody that you were interested in from a historical perspective, what's it like playing against Aiden, playing Hynek?
Well, I have to be honest, during the time that I was aware of Hynek, mm-hmm. I was doing a lot of social research.
Mm.
Getting in touch with the stars?
Yeah.
Is that so, what they call that?
I wasn't too wrapped
like
tight. I wasn't wrapped too tight in those days. Yeah, still aren't probably. But I just remember being in the bars and saying, you know, we've known UFOs exist for a long, long time and getting into conversations about it,
yeah.
you know, pretty consistently. You know, the one thing about Aiden is that he's always trying stuff. Every time he comes at it, he wants it to be fresh. And that's always really invigorating and inspiring. I really don't have an intellectual association, or I try not to have any intellectual associations at all, you know, when I'm doing what I do. But I don't really think of him. I think of him as Hynek.
Mm.
And even, I don't even think of that. I'm working off of him in the circumstance that we're in, doing what he's doing.
Right.
And then it becomes this crazy ride, you know.
When you're doing a period piece, once you start to jump into whatever wardrobe it is, you certainly get a feeling for it. But I always say that your comfort as an actor, everything starts with the words. You can be in costume dramas and you feel like a putz because, you know, the story isn't great, the words aren't great, and you look like a guy dressed up as a cowboy. Or it doesn't look so good. This is different. This is like Flags of Our Fathers or Band of Brothers. They're both two huge epic World War II stories. The words were so fantastic.
Neil, I'll Venmo you back whatever I owe you for that.
It's hard to mess up. It really is. And Neil Clint Eastwood's school of, you know, hit your mark, stay your lines correctly, and move on, because the words are already there, the costume's there, everything's there. And in this, it was the same. You know, the words were always so fantastic and really kind of spot on to each situation that the wardrobe was just the bonus. That being said, the wardrobes were fantastic.
Oh, you know, unbelievable.
So
the hats, to the uniforms, to the women's outfits, the men's outfits, everything was like top-notch and done perfectly. And especially when you walk into Hynek's house, it was so perfectly the period, and into our offices and everything else. They really tried to go for authenticity in everything that they did. And I truly believe that they did. And that doesn't happen often on television because it's generally so rushed.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. With this, Sean and the rest of the company, they said, all right, we're going to do this, but we're going to do it right. So let's work our tails off and try to tell the best story that we possibly can. And boy, I'm telling you, just looking at some of the stuff, I'm kind of blown away by how amazing it all looked. And I get to be part of it. It's pretty fantastic.
Well, I'll just ask you, too, when you came into this, did you have preconceived notions about, I have an open mind to these kinds of things, this show has changed me a little bit?
One of my favorite moments of the whole show, and literally, Sean was directing it. We're doing a second unit thing, and we're outside, and he says, okay, here comes the spacecraft. It's going to roll out of the hangar, and you're going to see it coming out. Of course, there's nothing there. It's my imagination.
Right.
And I'm looking at it, and I'm kind of like in, you know, wow and wonderment, and Sean's like, oh, no. You've seen these before. This is just a really cool one. It was interesting because I was like, oh, that's right. As a government guy within the story, whatever the case is, this is what we're going for. And I believe it. You know, there were these things. You know, being a devout Catholic that I am, and I know Michael's the same way, it would be a bit presumptuous and egotistical for us to think that we are the only things that were ever created out there. So maybe we are, maybe we're not, but to think that it's just us, I'm not so sure that we're all smart enough. It's like saying, okay, when did time begin and where does the universe end? I don't know any person on this planet who's smart enough to answer that question. And that's the great thing about this show. There are people, you know, back in the 50s or during this time who saw these things and documented it. And it's pretty awesome to be part of a character who did that. And just a lot of fun. The make-believe is great. But when you get these fact-based things and you're talking about things that are what-ifs, I love that stuff.
Michael, in your research, seeing the cases that Sean and David have brought in for this, did it change anything? Did it exacerbate anything for you or just keep you in the same path?
I went down the rabbit hole. It was pretty interesting. One of the things that occurred to me, I listened to a lot of lectures and saw a lot of people being interviewed. And one of the things that kept coming up was they kept saying, well, they're not here to hurt us. And so many people were saying that they came from thousands of years in the future. So that rings true to me, you know. All I can work with is what rings true
Absolutely.
For me. And that really opened up a whole awareness for me to step into and try on. And that's all I'm doing is trying everything on. Even today, I'm trying on today.
Yeah.
But it just was so, is so, I would say, literally mind-blowing because it's so far past anything that we can imagine with our, or certainly conceive in our linear understanding of the way we normally look at things. Mm-hmm. But with our technology now, we're beginning to get a glimpse of what it is that may be coming down the pike.
Whether you believe or you don't believe, I said this to Sean, there isn't a single night that I look out to the sky anymore since I started the show and don't think, And that's the great thing about this show. It just makes you think. And there aren't enough shows that make you think anymore. And Project Blue Book is certainly one of those shows that makes you really think, what else? It could be, you know, and I like that.
Yeah, I do too. And, you know, just bringing it back before we close it out, this is the episode where we get to see Quinn doing that. He kills a light bulb at the end.
Yeah.
We've got him in that car and having that crazy experience. Now you've got this guy that, you know, he's a case closer, suddenly having everything shaken in him to be able to easily say, let's just close a case. Because this, for him, he knows there's anecdotal evidence that comes from him this time that's not explainable.
100%. And look, the thing with the car, there's some really strong reports from people who have had very similar experiences with the car. And then when you talk about an experimental aircraft that has the ability to do that, which is some of the technology at the time, again, makes sense. Do we indulge a little bit? Of course.
Mm-hmm.
Touching the lamp at the end, static electricity, we're talking 50s, you know, during at the time. Very easy to see that happening. So what we love to do is sort of bring the audience along on that ride and you sort of get to choose how you want to feel about it.
Absolutely. Well, the gentleman at the end of the episode, Valentine and Harding say they wonder if Hynek's going to be a problem that needs solving. Maybe it's Hynek and Quinn are going to be problems that need solving as we move along. Well, we'll leave it on that high note. But I want to thank our wonderful guests for being here to talk about the episode. Michael, thank you so much for being here. Neil, thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you.
And Sean, thank you for being with us and being able to dig into story for us.
My pleasure. Thank you, man. So good to hear your voice.
Thank you, guys. You too.
As always, I have to thank our wonderful guests and my wonderful podcasting team, producer Kirby Dixon, producer and editor Paul Terry, our mixer and master Dave Draper, and LA Digital for hosting us again this week. If you're enjoying the show, give us a review, subscribe on iTunes or whatever service you download your favorite podcasts from. And of course, you can reach out to us on Twitter with questions that we can ask the executive producers or our special guests that we have coming up. You can come and find me on Twitter at my handle, at Tara D. Bennett, or check us out at scifiwire.com. We'll be cracking new cases next week.